You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2004, tech entrepreneur Nathan Myhrvold set out to write a book on contemporary cooking techniques, but the more time he spent on the subject, the deeper he was pulled into the uncharted areas of cooking science. The project soon morphed into an all-encompassing encyclopedia that brought elite chefs, master craftsmen, scientists, journalists, photographers, an instrument maker, and a support staff into one of the most technologically advanced kitchens in the world. The result is Modernist Cuisine, a six-volume encyclopedic reference set that weighs in at over 50 pounds and spans 2,400 pages. It details the history, process, tools, and techniques of modernist cooking, a style that merges scientific investigation with traditional cooking. Mr. Myhrvold's Cooking Lab published this set, and I'm very pleased that it brings scientist, author, cook, and photographer Nathan Myhrvold to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Do you see this collection as an encyclopedia, as a cookbook with a lot of explanation, as a textbook?
Well, maybe all of the above. Encyclopedias usually have lots of separate articles without a single narrative thread. Ours does have a narrative thread. The other thing is encyclopedia is kind of a 20th century word. Wikipedia has so destroyed the idea of encyclopedias in physical form that it's probably not a good thing to call it.
But it would be difficult to sit down and read this series of books.
Hey, look,
so how do you, even though it has a narrative thread, how do you envision people using them?
Well, as hard as it may be to read, guess what? It was harder to write.
I'll bet.
And, you know, we tried to design the book so that people could dip into it and read it in a couple of different ways. It's not like a novel where you ought to start at page one and go to the end. As you say, very few people will do that. So we tried to make it so that you could skip around. The book is full of cross-references to other parts of the book that are relevant. And so some people are going to start at page one, chapter one. Some are going to just start at random and then flop around inside.
It's also got gorgeous photographs. I imagine people are going to come upon a picture and say, oh, I want to know what that's all about.
Well,
did you take those photographs?
Not all of them, but I set the goal for us that we would show people a vision of food they hadn't seen before. And the reason is we cover lots of things that might seem a little daunting or intimidating. Science of cooking, some of the more technical aspects of how a great chef produces a particular dish. And if you say that in all its technical glory, it can sound like, God, that's maybe more advanced than I care to know. But if you have a cool photo, it draws people in. And then pretty soon they're reading the caption and you kind of got them hooked.
Although some of these things would be impossible to duplicate at home unless you had thousands and thousands of dollars. I would assume that the people who are going to get the most out of this are other chefs who are curious about how somebody like Adria or Blumenthal proceeds.
Well, okay, you said use the word curious, which is I think, the right word. We wrote the book for people who are passionate and curious about food. And some of those people won't cook from it at all. They'll treat it like a coffee table book that lets them learn. They're curious. How does Ferran Adrià or Heston Blumenthal or Thomas Keller, how do they do some of those things? Other people will cook from it. And you know, out of 1,500 recipes, probably half of them anybody can do at home. Maybe another 25%, if you buy some special equipment, you could do, but nothing terribly expensive. And the last 25%, good luck. Those are hard. But we had a philosophy that
some of these guys have laboratories, some of these chefs.
Sure. And hey, there's recipes in there that they will find hard. But we had a philosophy of not dumbing it down. We'd say, look, we'll tell you the whole span. You can do a lot of them.
And you begin, talking about the whole span, you begin with the origins of cooking. Is it necessary to know this history in order to cook well today?
I think necessary is perhaps a strong word. I think it's cool to learn about the history of cooking, to have a perspective that cooking is a constantly evolving thing. I got so many questions while we were writing the book about saying, well, what about traditional cooking? And of course, traditional cooking is a little bit of a mythological creation. There was no single traditional cooking. Cooking evolves. You know, Italians didn't used to have tomatoes until the New World was discovered. We didn't used to have ice cream or hamburgers or pizza. We're always evolving new things.
And most people were burning wood or peat or something else, but in the end, it winds up working over a fire, isn't it?
Well, in fact, our history of cooking starts with fire. We start all the way at the beginning. And we tried to sketch the elements of the history of cooking that would be interesting in fasting and would inform this. Now, can you cook the recipes without knowing that? Yes, you can. But I thought it was important to add, because we wanted this book to be a sort of a one-stop reference for what 21st century cooking is about.
Isn't your professional background in science and technology? You were Microsoft's first chief technology officer, weren't you?
Yep.
So what got you thinking about writing an in-depth book about cooking?
Well, I've always loved cooking. When I was 9 years old, I told my mother I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner all by myself. I banned her from the kitchen, went to the library, got all these books.
Did you brine the turkey?
I didn't brine the turkey. This was a pre-brining era. When I was nine, and brining had been invented, but it wasn't popular for turkey yet. So, I did an okay job, but it got me hooked on it. So I was a very serious amateur chef my whole life. While working at Microsoft, I got Bill Gates to give me a leave of absence so I could go to a chef school in France. Mm-hmm. But the chef school wouldn't take me until I'd worked in a restaurant. So I worked at a French restaurant called Rover's in Seattle for one night a week for 2 years. So I really have been into cooking as much as I've been into anything else.
Have you financed this project yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Because this is turned out to be a rather complicated project. Maybe you don't want to tell me, but... how much did it wind up costing?
So I decided early on I was not going to repeat this, in part because just recounting it is too painful. But I realized that this was such a different project that no publishers are conservative. They wouldn't have financed it. And fortunately, I was in a position where I could.
You outlined 10 principles of modernist cuisine. How did you come up with those guidelines?
Well, in the 1970s, there was a famous 10 principles of nouvelle cuisine in France. And not only did that change French cuisine, but it directly inspired new American cuisine. But people like Larry Faragione and Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower and a whole variety of other people.
Barry Wine.
Barry Wine here in New York, absolutely. There's a recent article about Quilted Giraffe in Town and Country that talks about his role. Those people took this great inspiration that, hey, that if the French can do new stuff, we can too. And even though they didn't take a lot of the content, just the idea of renovating cuisine was important. Well, I think we're in a period of renewal similar to that now, and so I thought we'd make our 10 principles.
And they've changed because the technology has changed or because food styles have changed?
Well, that and more. If you look at the very biggest picture, there's more diversity of food available in New York City today than at any point in history. And, that's also true in Columbus, Ohio. That's true all over the place. We love variety. And we get that variety both by importing foreign cuisine. So you didn't used to be able to find sushi in Columbus, but I'm sure you can now.
Now you find some of the best ice cream in the country, Jenny's ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about that?
I do know about Jenny's ice cream, and it's excellent. One of the avenues for increasing culinary diversity is by importing a foreign cuisine like sushi or something else. But another way is pure creativity. And we're at a stage where chefs have invented so many interesting techniques. And in addition, food scientists have learned so much about food that I thought it was time to take that body of knowledge and make it accessible to chefs and food lovers.
But there seem to be two trends as I see it here. One is taking older techniques and modernizing them with something like sous vide, which, if I remember correctly, was originally done by putting food inside of a pork bladder and cooking it very slowly. Now you use fancy machines. And then you have the other side, people like Ferran Adrià, who do very sophisticated chemistry.
Well, and another way to view it is, if you look at it from the point of view of the plate or the diner, some of the food looks entirely conventional, although it's been created by a method that is superior in some way. It's easier, it's more convenient, it gives you a result you couldn't otherwise get, but it still looks like food. Or you have the food that Ferran and some other chefs create that deliberately doesn't look like food. It deliberately breaks conventions and rules where you think, oh my God, what is it? Was this beamed down from the Starship Enterprise? Where'd it come from? And this idea of modernist cuisine really encompasses both.
But you say here one of your rules is that you should start off cooking in the old-fashioned way, and learn all the old techniques in the same way that art teachers will sometimes tell budding artists that they got to learn to draw before they decide to find their own style.
Well, you know, I did learn all the classics, and they were drilled into me again in chef school in France. So I think it's important to understand where cooking came from. But it's also important to know that you can break some rules. And if you're so hidebound in this, you're so, you know, an example we use in the history section is plated dishes. The idea that the chef puts all the food on the plate in the kitchen, that's new. Mm. In fact, it started in the 1960s at a restaurant called Trois Gros. Prior to that, in a fancy restaurant, a waiter plated everything. They brought out a platter and they put it onto your plate, which means the chef had no control over how it looked. And they also simplified the dishes, very few things on the plate, because it was too hard for the waiter to do all this stuff. What a change that's made just in our lifetimes, at least my lifetime, and I'm guessing yours, that people had this fundamental shift. And if you think today about all the fancy stuff people will do on a plate in every level of restaurant, that's an example of something that was a real innovation. It broke a rule.
My guest is Nathan Myhrvold, M-Y-H-R-V-O-L-D. His Modernist Cuisine is published by The Cooking Lab, has a foreword by Ferran Adrià, who was this famous chef from a restaurant called El Bulli in Spain, although he's just closed the restaurant, hasn't he?
Well, he's closed the restaurant to reopen it as a sort of a culinary innovation center. El Bulli was always a strange restaurant. It was only open 6 months of the year. The other 6 months they'd spend researching new dishes. There's only one seating a night. They would have about 8,000 places for dinner in a year, and they'd have 2 million requests for that. So it never was really a real restaurant anyway, in the sort of the conventional sense of a neighborhood restaurant. And he's decided to kind of, I like to explain it with Tibetan Buddhism. He's sort of ascended to a higher plane of existence, and now he's a bodhisattva that will come down and kind of continue to help the rest of us.
Well, he's associated with what's come to be known as molecular gastronomy, although there's a big controversy over whether that is a good phrase to describe what's going on.
It's one of the things we cover in the history chapter. So molecular gastronomy is a name that came from some scientific conferences in the 1990s that first started exploring some aspects of using food science to look at fine dining and home dining. Food science is a very old field, but it hadn't focused as much on the fine dining side. So chefs generally hate that term. They think it's off-putting to people. They think it categorizes them too much. Meanwhile, the food scientists, Dr. Hervé Thies is a food scientist associated with that. He hates using it to call it food either. So we came up with this concept of modernist cuisine as a very broad title that encompasses some of what people have called molecular as well as food that isn't.
And you say that it has similarities in some ways to the development of Impressionist painting.
So, you know, in the one of the great things in modern art was this idea of breaking rules. And the French Impressionists were probably the single most clear example of that. They broke the rules for painting. It was horrendously controversial. We reprint some cartoons in the book from French newspapers in the 1970s. One shows a pregnant woman being refused admission to an Impressionist gallery on the grounds that the paintings were so ugly they'd cause her to miscarry. Now, that's absurd because today these are maybe the best-loved paintings on Earth. Similarly, when chefs like Ferran and others have broken culinary conventions, it's been hugely controversial. But ultimately, the spirit of it is about breaking rules to understand art.
Now, I mentioned sous vide. Didn't this project begin as a sous vide cookbook? Can you explain sous vide?
So sous vide is a technique that was developed, the earliest aspects of it in the 1960s for NASA for the space program, actually. Then a Swedish hospital system started using it. And the idea was you would seal food in a plastic bag and cook it by immersing it in hot water. Some of us remember there was a frozen food called boil in the bag many years ago that was a little bit like that. Well, today sous vide has changed a bit. It really is about cooking food at low temperature so you can cook it very, very precisely.
And we had some problems with the health department here in New York where they wanted to make sure that chefs were doing it right because they were afraid that bacteria would grow. It cooks so slowly.
Well, so there's been a lot of concern about that. And in 2006, there was a big brouhaha where the U.S., the New York Health Department frankly overreacted wildly sort of persecuted chefs doing sous vide out of a well-meaning notion that it might be dangerous. But I think all those issues are pretty much resolved at this point.
You have some other techniques, tools that you talk about. What's a combi oven?
So we're familiar with ovens that control temperature. And these ovens allow you to adjust the temperature of the food, or of the air, excuse me, but not the humidity. Now, we all know on a hot summer day, people say, well, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. It's true for your food also. And that's because food is mostly water. So a combi oven is an oven that controls both temperature and humidity.
So you have dry bulbs and wet bulbs? How does that work?
Well, the way that meteorologists for years have determined humidity is by having two thermometers. And one of them has a little sock on it, literally a little cloth sock that hangs into water, and it's called a wet bulb thermometer. And if there's 100% humidity, then the wet bulb and dry bulb tell you the same temperature. But and so controlling humidity is very important. Another name for these ovens, by the way, is steam ovens. People may know them more as that. So they inject steam and moisture because otherwise a conventional oven is spending most of its energy drying your food out, not just heating it.
But this is different than a convection oven.
A convection oven is an oven with a fan, mm-hmm. basically. Now, if you add steam, you probably also add a fan. So they're sometimes called convection steam ovens. Combi oven stands for combination oven, meaning it can do all those three things.
And I can buy this for my home?
Recently, people have offered it for the home. You know, and for 20 years, it's been a restaurant item and a pretty expensive one, a $10,000 oven that you might find at a restaurant or a deli. Delis use them quite often. But in the last 2 years, homemakers, Thermador, Gaggenau, Viking, and others either have or will have home combi ovens.
And what's a rotary evaporator?
Rotary evaporator is an example of a pretty exotic thing used in organic chemistry labs, and also pharma companies or biotech companies might use it. It is basically a really high-tech distillation thing. So it's a still. But it's a still that allows you to distill liquids at very low temperature. And you use it basically for making essential oils or essences.
And then you have Paco jets. You have an immersion blender that relies on sound waves.
Yep. So one of the things that a variety of chefs around the world have started to do, starting maybe 10 years ago, really in earnest, is look at ways in which equipment that was designed for a chemistry lab or a medical lab could be repurposed to be used in the kitchen. And it turns out some of them work great, some of them don't. But we explored all of those different kinds of equipment in this book.
For example, about how to use a pressure cooker to make a stock. I still like the old-fashioned method of just letting it cook on a low flame all night.
Well, hey, you're welcome to do that. I'm not going to ever tell anybody how they should prefer something, but boy, pressure cookers are awesome for making stock.
We have very little time, but can you talk about your recipe for the ultimate cheeseburger and French fries? This is not something that I would expect in a book that has a lot of writing about Ferran Adrià.
Well, that's why we put it in. You know, high-end food doesn't have to be about fancy ingredients. If you love hamburgers, there's such a thing as the ultimate hamburger. So we set out on a quest to make the ultimate cheeseburger. So we make our own cheese for the cheese slice so that it melts perfectly and doesn't get greasy. We have a special technique for grinding the burger, a special technique for cooking the burger, which actually involves liquid nitrogen, believe it or not, and the bun and the ketchup. So every element of the burger, we try to refine it to the ultimate.
And you recommend flipping the burger a lot. The old method was you put it on one side, you let it cook, and then you put it on the other side. Now we're being told, if you keep on flipping it every minute or 2 minutes, you're actually going to get a better crust and better cooked burger.
That's right. You get a more even heat distribution. Although our favorite method of cooking is sous vide followed by liquid nitrogen followed by a deep fryer, believe it or not.
Nathan Mervold's Modernist Cuisine. How many books altogether?
It's six books. Six books, 2,438 pages.
And 50 pounds.
Yeah.
It's published by the Cooking Lab. Gorgeous books, by the way. Thank you so much for coming by to talk about them.
Well, thank you for having me.